From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. The way judges wind up on the bench in North Carolina is changing this year. For one thing, elections will be partisan thanks to the passage of House Bill 100 last March. Governor Roy Cooper vetoed that bill, which the legislature easily overrode the next day. Supporters contend partisan races give voters more information. Opponents say they further politicize the court. The GOP-dominated legislature is also redrawing judicial districts. The current districts have been in effect since 1955. Democrats accuse the Republican Party of racially gerrymandering those maps as well. And Senate Bill 656, another bill vetoed by the Democratic governor and promptly overridden, eliminates judicial primaries this year. However, a U.S. District Court judge is hearing arguments today, Wednesday, in Greensboro from Democrats who will argue for the court to restore the May primary while their lawsuit over the issue goes to trial. The General Assembly is also considering shifting from an election process to an appointment system for judges. That's just a smattering of issues to unpack when we're talking about judicial reform. To help us do that today, we have Stephen Meinhold, professor of political science at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. He specializes in American government, public law, and judicial politics. He also serves as the UNCW Faculty Senate President. Professor Stephen Meinhold, welcome to Coastline.
Good afternoon.
We're inviting you to join the conversation. Have you followed the proposed changes to North Carolina's judicial system? Do you pay attention to judicial races? If you're a faithful voter, tell us how you generally vote for judges. Is the selection of judges an afterthought for you when you go to the polls? If not, what selection process would you like to see when it comes to finding a qualified judge? Call us during this live discussion on this Wednesday at 910-343-1138 or email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Stephen Meinhold, UNCW political science professor, tell us first about what kinds of courts, what kind of judges we're talking about for people who've sort of tangentially followed this but don't really understand the court system in the state. What courts would be affected by some of these changes?
Of course. Thank you very much. I'd like to start with the reminding listeners that we have 51 judicial legal systems in the United States of America. We have a federal legal system, and we have 50 state court systems. And North Carolina is one of those state court systems. If you think of our national court system, our federal court system, having three levels, trial courts, appellate courts, and a court of last resort, everybody's heard of the Supreme Court. Most of the 50 states have a very similar three-tiered system to what is represented in the Constitution, Article 3 of the Constitution, by laws passed by Congress for our federal system. So in North Carolina, we have trial courts, we have an intermediate appeals court, and a court of last resort, a state Supreme Court. At the trial level, where a person is most likely to have an experience with the legal system, there are two different trial courts, district courts and superior courts, and then an intermediate court of appeals and a state Supreme Court. Judges have to be selected for all of those levels, and they're sometimes selected differently at each level. That's true across all 50 states.
Now, most recently, and there's some North Carolina history here that we can get into, but most recently, these have been nonpartisan elections. Voters go to the polls, and while they're choosing other candidates for other offices, also when you get to the end of the ballot, you see the possible candidates for judge. Now, we've seen certainly people outside those polling stations handing out, these are the judges to vote for if you're a Democrat, these are the judges to vote for if you're a Republican. But they have been nonpartisan elections. What does that mean, Stephen Meinhold?
Well, when an election is nonpartisan, there's no party label or party cue that appears next to the individual candidate's name on the ballot. And I think we'll talk here in just a minute about the possible differences between partisan and nonpartisan elections. We do have political science research that shows specifically in judicial elections, that partisan cues partisan elections have the result of increasing voter turnout. And we know that's the case. We believe that the reason is party label gives some information to a voter that they wouldn't ordinarily have about how that judge is likely to behave one way or the other on the bench after they're selected. So we know that because of something called roll-off. Roll-off is a political science concept. If you recall voting for president of the United States a year and a half ago, you'll remember that you vote for president and then every race after that down the ballot. As the races get closer to the end of the ballot, fewer and fewer people vote, and judicial elections are often toward the end of the ballot. And when they're partisan and at the end of the ballot, there tends to be less roll-off, more people vote than if they're nonpartisan and at the end of the ballot where fewer people will vote.
Now, could you argue, if you're looking at the support for making judicial elections partisan, couldn't you argue, well, if I am affiliated with a particular party, that does give me more information about how this judge might vote. Therefore, I feel more secure in pushing the button for this guy or this woman.
Well, if it's helpful to listeners, one way to conceptualize this whole debate about choosing judges is to think of a continuum from what you want your judicial branch to look like, how you want your judges to behave. On one side of that continuum is complete independence from politics, complete independence from the legislative branch, complete independence from voters. And you'll hear advocates of that judicial independence talk about objective, nonpartisan, unbiased judges. And many of us have that vision of a legal system in our mind, maybe going all the way back to elementary school or middle school. On the other end of that continuum is accountability. So the continuum goes from independence to accountability. The advocates of accountability say that judges should be held accountable for the decisions they make, and they should be held accountable by voters because in the United States of America, that's how we hold our politicians accountable. We do it through voting in our democracy.
So then you're saying the people on the accountability end of the spectrum would be also supporters of partisan elections, because if a judge didn't vote along predictably Republican lines or predictably Democratic lines, then voters could oust the judge. Is that what you're saying? So then what is the argument for the other end of the spectrum? Is there even such a thing? I mean, you were describing it as objective, nonpartisan. Does that even exist? Can you filter the interpretation? Can you interpret law through a truly nonpartisan, objective filter?
Well, I'm a political scientist, and my job is to view the actions of the legal system through the lens of political science, maybe rather than the lens of that a law school professor might have. So if coming at this from the perspective of political science, judges are political actors. And I think we all understand that at some level, that a judge, once they're selected, comes to the bench with personal experience, life experience, political experience often. We must remember that today, all across this country, more judges are elected than appointed. Most states pick their trial court level judges through election of one kind or another. Now, it's often and increasingly nonpartisan versus partisan, but they are elected. So
did you just say it's increasingly nonpartisan versus partisan elections? So you're saying across the country, elections have been moving towards nonpartisan constructs.
Yes, that's true. And there are plenty of advocates out there for partisan elections, but nonpartisan election, more states have been moving toward nonpartisan elections.
Why
than
is
partisan.
That?
I think there's still this grand idea in our American political culture that we want the judicial branch to be nonpartisan, unbiased, objective, and legislatures have been responding to that around the country by moving toward nonpartisan elections. In fact, increasingly, throughout the history of the United States, if you went back 200 years, what you'd see are partisan elections everywhere. And as partisan elections were then replaced with a judicial selection called the commissions or merit plans, sometimes called the Missouri plan, where judges are appointed by a governor, in a couple of states by the legislature, but mostly by the governor, after recommendation from a commission, and then held to a retention election. Those retention elections are by definition nonpartisan. There's nobody else on the ballot. It's just the judge who's currently in office. So we see a trajectory here where we've gone from partisan elections to commissions to nonpartisan elections at the trial court level. It's a little more, the landscape's a little more complicated at the appellate and Supreme Court level.
So then through the lens of a political scientist, why is North Carolina moving in the other direction towards partisan elections?
Well, we've had partisan elections in the past, so we're bouncing around here a little bit. I can't speak for the views of the legislature and the governor and their interest in moving elections one way or the other. It's interesting. There have been public opinion polls done and reported by very, very good political scientist Jim Gibson at Washington University in St. Louis, where he shows that actually voters, when you ask them about what they want out of courts, objective judges is about third or fourth on the list, depending on how you ask the questions. They want fair judges. They want fair comes before objective in terms of the normative values that voters place on judges. But I think it's fair to say that voters are of mixed minds about whether they want to have a say in who the judges are or whether they want to give that choice to someone else.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're taking a look at changes to the judicial system in North Carolina. We're exploring the potential impacts of proposed reforms with political science professor Stephen Meinhold of UNCW. He's answering your questions on this Wednesday. You can call us during the live edition at 910-343-1138 or email us today at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Today we're exploring the ways North Carolina Republicans are restructuring the way judges wind up on the bench, as well as we'll get into prospects for the new maps after 62 years of the same judicial districts. Stephen Meinhold, professor of political science with a specialty in the judicial system at UNCW, is with us today to answer your questions. There are two ways you can get your question in during the live Wednesday discussion. You can either call us at 910-343-1138, or you can email us at coastline@whqr.org. And Professor Stephen Meinhold, just before we went to break, you were explaining that across the country, there has been a larger movement towards nonpartisan judicial elections, and it sort of evolved from partisan elections to some sort of appointment process to nonpartisan elections. Just take us through North Carolina's history when it comes to how we've selected judges.
North Carolina's history is like that of most states east of the Mississippi, and that is our judicial elections have been partisan in orientation for most of the history of North Carolina, and that includes the all levels, whether we're talking about the trial court level, again, that level that you're most likely, whether it's a traffic ticket or a more serious violent crime, and then the Intermediate Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court. All of those judicial judges have been elected historically, and they were elected with a partisan label appearing on the ballot. It's only this recent times where we've experimented with nonpartisan, and of course we have not used a commission, although there is a legislative proposal that's being pushed very strongly in Raleigh right now that would put a constitutional amendment to voters to allow for a judicial appointment system, a commission system that is, again, I referred to it earlier as a merit plan or a Missouri plan, it's sometimes called. And we'll see how that unfolds.
But as it stands now, generally, North Carolina is moving in a different direction than the rest of the country when it comes to moving towards partisan elections.
Well, that would be true. The proposal to create a commission would be very in line with the approach that is used for selecting judges at the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals level. The majority of states choose their Supreme Court judges and their intermediate Court of Appeals judges using a commission form, so not using election at all. Most of those commissions look something like what's being proposed currently, at least the last iteration that I saw, what's being proposed for North Carolina, which would involve public input to a commission that has commissioners named by the legislature and I think by the governor, well, I can't recall without the legislation in front of me, and then that commission would recommend three judges to the legislature, and legislature would recommend choices to the governor for a gubernatorial appointment, and then the judge would be subject to a retention election at the second election after they've been appointed.
And you alluded to a retention election in our first segment. Just for folks who didn't catch that, explain how that's different from, say, a competitive election.
In a judicial retention election, the judge's name appears on the ballot, often with a statement that says something like, do you approve of the way Judge X is doing their job, or something like, should Judge X be continued for another 6-year term or another 8-year term or 10-year term, depending on the length of term that that judge has been appointed to. They appear mostly with no partisan label in a retention election, and that's very different. And our advocates of partisan elections and advocates of judicial elections, period, argue that that provides a very false choice to a voter. It's very difficult for a voter. It's difficult enough for a voter to have information about the performance of a judge. It's made especially difficult when the choice is between the judge that you know or some judge that you have no idea who it would be, because that judge will be replaced by someone that's picked by the same process, a gubernatorial appointment, most likely, through that commission. So you're really putting a voter in a difficult place by having to make a choice, but it's not really a choice.
And so you're saying the practical outcome of that tends to be, in retention elections, judges keep their seats.
Judges are overwhelmingly retained in retention elections. There's some variation across the country where some parts of the country are more likely to toss a judge out than others, but overwhelmingly and by substantial majorities, judges are retained in those elections.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM in Wilmington and 98.9 in Myrtle Beach. We're learning about North Carolina's proposed and actual changes to the judiciary. Answering your questions on this Wednesday, Stephen Meinhold. He's a professor of political science at UNCW, where he specializes in American government, public law, and judicial politics. He also serves as the UNCW Faculty Senate President. And we want to hear from you. You can call us during the live Wednesday show at 910-343-1138 or email us today at coastline@whqr.org. And we heard from Hannah in Wilmington. She asks, if we pursue partisan elections, where will that put moderate judges? Will there be a balance between left and right, like we see on the Supreme Court? Stephen Meinhold.
Great question. The largest political party of voters in North Carolina is unidentified or independent. And that's not a political party that can appear on ballots. So if you're a listener and you think to yourself, well, I don't really identify with the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. I identify myself as an independent moderate. I believe that's how the caller's referring to it. That's not a party label that can appear on the ballot. Moderate's not going to appear. You're only going to get a party Q for the two major political parties. And that's mostly true across the country, although there are some states where third parties have a significant enough influence to be listed on the ballot for judges. But primarily across this country, it's judges being listed as Democrat or Republican. So moderate judges are going to have to make it politically. We'll have to make a choice about running and appearing as listed as either a Democrat or Republican.
And just getting back to this idea of, you referred to it as the grand idea of the nonpartisan, completely objective judge. What does research tell us about the outcomes of, even in a nonpartisan situation where a judge is not identifying with any political party, do we still see partisan outcomes? Is there a way to quantify that?
Political scientists have been studying judicial behavior since the beginning of political science. We view judges as political actors. But I should add that, and listeners will recall that I described our three-tier judicial system. And at the highest tier, at the Supreme Court level, there's a lot of discretion for the judge at that level to make decisions. They're very policy-oriented decisions at that level. And say an interpretation of the state constitution, for example. There's a lot of room for political ideology and experience to influence the outcome of a judge's decision, because there really isn't a guaranteed right or wrong in this particular example. As you work your way down that judicial system to the trial court level, there's less discretion for trial court judges when they're listening to a defendant or a victim or a plaintiff, a district attorney, et cetera. There's just less discretion available to those judges. So the political science research follows that. If you look only at trial court judges, you won't see a lot of differences in the outcome of judges' behavior, depending on whether or not the judges are selected through elections or appointment. Now, again, most trial court judges are still selected by election. You won't even find much difference if you compare the demographics of judges at the trial court level. You can look at female and male judges. You can look at judges with children, judges without children, and party ID of judges, and you don't see a lot of differences. As you work your way up the level, you see those differences, and whether it's the North Carolina Supreme Court or the federal Supreme Court, I think we all acknowledge that the judges there are influenced by their political ideology.
So now if we take a look at this appointment process that is not something that has passed, this is something that's been proposed, and you talked about the possible structure of a commission, or that selection process. There are only a few states at this point, is that true, Rhode Island and Virginia, that appoint judges in this way? Can you kind of take us through what the norm is for that around the country?
Well, the classic merit plan or Missouri plan, commission plan for selecting judges has three components. Generally, they look like someone recommends judges to a commission. The commission is made up of commissioners appointed by usually the legislative and the executive branch, though not always, but usually. The appointment commission is judicial. They call it a judicial nominating commission, JNC. That judicial nominating commission is supposed to be reflective of both political parties. You're not supposed to have a commission that has only commissioners from one political party. They recommend a slate of names to the governor, and then the governor of that state makes the appointment, and then those judges are held to some retention election later on that we talked about. So there's some input. The input sometimes varies. It comes from citizens. It might come from bar associations. It might come from a variety of different places. The names go to a commission. The commission recommends a list of names to the governor. The governor makes an appointment.
Okay, I'm going to ask a political question here, which as a political scientist, I don't know if you're going to back away from this, but why can you boil this down to a really simple idea here? We had a conversation that our producer Rachel Keith recorded with retired senior Superior Court Judge Donald Stevens, who we'll talk a little bit more about him later. But he's essentially said that legislative leaders have faced a great deal of opposition and frustration recently in the court system. And that's why the GOP is interested in making all these changes to the judicial system in North Carolina. Democratic Party officials are, of course, accusing the Republican Party of cherry-picking their judges so that they can get the partisan outcomes that they're looking for. Is that what's going on here through the lens of political science?
Well, politics is the authoritative allocation of values for a society, and elected officials who have power are going to have preferences about how those values should be applied to all of us, and that's what it means to win. That's why it's so important that citizens participate in the political process. You can't affect the outcome if you're not participating. And when in our country, we have a winner-take-all system. So if your political party wins one more vote than the other political party, you have all of the control of that political body. And it's neither surprising nor inconsistent with history that a political body that is not getting the outcomes they want from any other political branch of government, and that includes the courts, would make some effort to try to change the either the selection process or the boundaries or whatever the features are. It's true that we don't make changes to our court systems very often. So these proposals, I guess it's reasonable to say that I think it's unlikely that this proposal actually pass the constitutional if it comes out of the legislature and it goes to the voters.
Which proposal? You're talking about the appointment
to change. Well, to change from a election system to a commission. I actually think it has at best a 50-50 chance, and because you're asking voters to give up having a say in the process, and that's not going to be an easy sell politically.
If the voters stay engaged.
If the voters stay engaged.
And this is when it comes to just simply voting for judges, you've talked about how judges wind up at the bottom of the ballot. Voters generally have a harder time getting information about judges. We don't really know about the effort that voters make in terms of getting information about judges.
Well, we know that we do know we've studied this as political scientists that voters have very little information about judicial candidates generally. So, you know, this is true of virtually all political science research that's been done. Voters just simply don't know very much about judicial candidates. So we're in a bit of a quandary here. We say we want to have influence over the people who represent us, and that includes judges. But voters don't know very much about judges. It's one of the arguments that advocates of partisan elections have been making increasingly, is that when you have partisan elections, more money is spent in the elections than if you have nonpartisan elections. And the natural inclination might be for people to say, wait a minute, we don't want more money to be spent on elections. That's a bad thing. But in reality, there's some research that's beginning to show that more money spent in partisan elections means that more voters actually hear about the judicial candidates who are running for election and know more about those candidates than in elections where they're nonpartisan, where no money gets spent, there's no party Q label on the ballot, and it's very difficult for a voter to find out, well, how would this judge behave if they're elected?
Now, if there's a judicial candidate who is affiliated with one of the two major parties, and that campaign gets a great deal of funding from those parties, is there even an unconscious kind of partisan debt that candidate would feel if he won a seat?
Well, these kinds of questions are very difficult to answer empirically. It often comes down to normative arguments about who you want having that influence. So if it's true that the political party is going to be more prominent and supporters and donors to a particular candidate's election are going to be more prominent in an election than an appointment system. But in the appointment system, there's still plenty of people making decisions about who the judges are going to be. And so we should be just as interested in whether the judicial system is favoring those interests, the interest of often lawyers who are making decisions about who the candidates or who the judges will be in an appointment system. than voters themselves. And so it's that tension that I described very early in the show between independence. Do you want a judicial system that's independent, or do you want one that's accountable? You're never going to have one that's completely on either side of the continuum. It's going to be somewhere in the middle. And that tension is it's okay to have that tension. And it's I don't find the current discussion in the state dispiriting in any way. And in fact, quite the opposite. It may bring attention to how we select our judges that among voters and listeners today that we wouldn't have had if the legislature hadn't been engaged in these activities.
So we've spent some time then on the differences between the election process for judges and some form of an appointment process. Another element to the reform that is actually in court today, it's U.S. District Court Judge Catherine Eagles, I guess, is deciding on this Wednesday whether to restore the May primary for judicial elections. That was eliminated. What does the elimination of judicial primaries mean? Does this make it impossible for unaffiliated candidates to get on the ballot at all?
I can't answer all of the specifics about the impact of the change. I can answer the general question is about having a primary. Of course, if you adopt the position that political parties should have an opportunity to pick their best candidate to represent them, then of course you should be opposed to a system where there's an elimination of that primary, where there are now going to be multiple candidates, perhaps from the same political party, appearing on the ballot. So that purpose of the primary to select who's going to represent that political party is very important.
And we're going to come back to this idea when we come back from the break. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM, talking about how changes to North Carolina's judicial selection process, the judicial maps, might affect judges, the resulting rulings. UNCW political science professor Stephen Meinhold is with us today, and he's answering your questions during the live Wednesday discussion. You can either call us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. This upcoming segment will be your last chance to get your question in. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. We're learning today about how judicial reforms proposed by the majority in the state legislature might affect judicial selection process, the judicial election process this year. Stephen Meinhold is our guest today. He's a professor of political science at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. He specializes in judicial politics. This is the last segment, so you have just a few more minutes to get your question in during the live Wednesday show at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. And Stephen Meinhold, just before we went to break, you were kind of explaining why political parties would not want to see a primary eliminated, because that whole primary process gives them a chance to sort of let their best candidates rise to the top. What are some of the other implications of eliminating the judicial primary this year?
Well, if we look back at the history of elections in the United States of America at all levels, including judicial elections, primaries emerged during the progressive era as a response to what we think of as party elders, party states people, and the smoke-filled back rooms making decisions about who would represent the political party when they were in an election that, of course, historically are Democrats and Republicans in the United States with two major political parties. So the primary process was a response to what was perceived as corruption by party leaders. Primaries, of course, allow the voters to pick in an election who will represent that party in a general election. And the loss of that power is a substantial one. Political parties then don't have control over who represents that party. And this would allow for confusion on the, again, part of a voter who uses party ID as a cue to make their decision. They don't know whether this is the Democrat candidate or the Republican candidate that those two parties would prefer to represent them and be elected.
The Associated Press reports that lawyers for GOP legislators say there's no constitutional obligation to hold primary elections, and Democrats can still organize and endorse candidates without them. Legislative leaders say the cancellation of the primary this year is designed to lessen confusion as they debate whether to redraw judicial election districts. What would the advantage to the majority party be to eliminating the primary? What's the political advantage there? Is there one?
We don't do this very often in terms of eliminating primaries, so I can't speak with confidence about research that would indicate whether such a change as eliminating the primary would advantage one political party over the other, either the major party or the minor party. So I'm a little reluctant to say from a standpoint of a political scientist what this is likely to do. But what it's guaranteed to do is frustrate voters and take away the authority of the voters in that party to choose the candidate of their choice to represent them. So it's pretty clear that it's going to create confusion for the voter. What advantage or disadvantage it has for the major party, I'm not so certain about.
You're listening to Coastline. We're learning about North Carolina's likely changes to the judiciary. Answering your questions during this live Wednesday discussion is UNCW political science professor Stephen Meinhold. He specializes in judicial politics. We want to hear from you on this Wednesday. If you have a question, you can give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. One listener writes, what about finding a way to incorporate more younger, fresh faces into the judicial system? As technology progresses, there should be a judge able to relate to millennials when it comes to these matters. Stephen Meinhold.
Age old question. no pun intended. Elected officials of all stripes tend to be older, and there's a reason for that. Being an elected official is hard work, and I admire those individuals who are willing to put themselves in the position of elected office. It requires a lot of time. The pay is never great, and it's less than what any talented individual could make with their time otherwise. So the consequence of those demands means that very few young people are in a position to be able to run for office. I don't think it is not so much that voters wouldn't elect a young person, it's that young people rarely run for political office, and when they do, sometimes they're criticized as not having a lot of experience. And whether we believe this or not, some voters prefer some life experience to no life experience at all. I don't think that we can change this with the judicial selection process, although I would note that recall my comments about the merit plan process and retention elections. In a retention election, judges are overwhelmingly retained. So there is one feature of the legislative proposal which could have some appeal to those wanting to diversify the judicial branch, and that's the maximum term that a judge might serve on a court. My recollection is that was something like 10 years in at least one of the legislative proposals. And that could have the consequence of creating some turnover, and that would be a chance for younger judges to have a chance at being elected or appointed.
And actually, one of the criticisms that retired senior superior court judge Donald Stevens had about some of these proposed changes, he was sort of saying some of these changes would make it just as easy. It would sort of level the playing field when it came to somebody who just came out of law school versus a very experienced judge who'd served on the bench for many years. And he was saying that this is actually, it was a criticism of these proposed changes, the implication being the older person with the life experience and particularly the experience on the bench would be a better choice.
I'm not defending one perspective or the other. I think it's clear that a term limit may have the likelihood of, because of turnover, creating opportunities for young young people interested in running for judgeships to have an opportunity. That's not going to happen in a system in which a retention election guarantees that 90% of the judges who just put their name on the ballot will get retained. So it's definitely a fair argument that with these retention elections, and even with elections, period, judges tend to get reelected. And breaking that cycle is not easy, but putting term limits in place would have potentially have that effect.
Let's talk for a moment about judicial redistricting. This is something that hasn't happened in North Carolina in more than half a century. So on the face of it, it sounds like we're more than due. Certainly, state leaders are required to redraw legislative districts and congressional districts every 10 years in accordance with the shifts in the U.S. Census data. Why hasn't the same mandate been in place for judicial districts?
The principle of drawing political boundaries is as old as our country, the process of drawing boundaries, and it has always been and will continue to be political. A political boundary of whatever kind you draw has implications. It has implications for the partisan nature of elections and judges and elected officials in that particular geographic area. It has implications because of the ways that people live nearby, people who are like them. And throughout the history of this country, whether it's judicial boundaries, election boundaries, or legislative boundaries, there is considerable political conflict about the drawing of those boundaries. And again, it's not surprising that the party in power would attempt to try to draw political boundaries that advantage that party. What we're seeing, and not only about this discussion of the partisan or the boundaries of judicial districts, but we're seeing this discussion with our congressional districts in North Carolina. We're seeing it with the discussion of congressional districts in Pennsylvania most recently. The Supreme Court's hearing a case about the Wisconsin congressional districts currently in this term of the Supreme Court, which is why they issued the stay for North Carolina legislative districts. And I think there will be increasingly more attention placed on what districts of all kinds look like, whether it's judicial districts. The principle generally that we follow in the country is one person, one vote, right? That judicial district should, or any district should have about the same number of people in it. And that's the purpose for the redistricting.
And when we look at the judicial redistricting, just the fact that it hasn't been mandated, these districts have not undergone any kind of adjustment since 1955, I believe it was. Does that also indicate that there aren't a lot of other controls, other rules around how these districts are drawn?
Right. So districts are drawn 50 different ways. There are 50 states. Every state draws districts at different levels within their state differently. There are partisan influences no matter how a state draws its districts. The reason that we don't do it more often is it's hard to do. Changing a district means moving voters from one particular geographic area and putting them in a different geographic area, and that has political consequences. And so getting agreement between parties, between a legislature, between a governor to redraw districts is always difficult. And that's why we see at every level of the government it taking longer and longer and longer to draw districts after every census that happens.
And of course, you know, we're hearing a lot from Democrats who are opposing many of these changes. According to one very left-leaning publication, Mother Jones, they write, the new maps would likely give Republican judges 70% of seats on North Carolina Superior and District Courts. That's according to an analysis by the Southern Coalition for Social Justice. That's a voting rights group based in Durham. And the groups are calling the new lines a gross political gerrymander of our state's legal system designed to ensure Republican judges will be elected in a disproportionate number of districts statewide. Now, of course, groups with partisan agendas are going to be alarmed. But where is the line between partisan and illegal or unconstitutional?
We don't know. The history, our political history in the United States is fraught, filled with examples of partisan gerrymandering. And the Supreme Court, the federal Supreme Court, has specifically stayed out of this issue of partisan gerrymandering. They've ruled racial gerrymandering unconstitutional, but they've stayed out, and they've made up many other decisions about redistricting, but they've really stayed away from this principal question that is in front of all of us now around the country, which is how much can you manipulate a district, a political district, whether that's a judicial one that we're talking about here. I don't know exactly what the consequences would be of the districts that are drawn, whether it would result in that number 70% being Republican judges being elected or not. But it very well may, and that's the whole purpose of drawing districts to advantage one party or of another, is to do precisely that, to get candidates of from your political party elected. But we're confronted with this very important normative question right now, and we're going to get a judgment from the Supreme Court in the Wisconsin case, which is going to have a very significant effect on how we think about this debate. And I don't think it's clear whether the Supreme Court will say that partisan gerrymandering is unconstitutional or not. And if they don't, then we'll just be back at this for who knows how long.
And as we know, courts have traditionally avoided the idea of determining partisan gerrymandering as much as possible. Racial gerrymandering has been something that has come before the courts and that they've ruled on earlier. But some people say partisan gerrymandering is or racial gerrymandering is just a proxy for partisan gerrymandering. But why, traditionally, in your view, have courts been reluctant to take this on?
Courts reasonably understand that if they're in the middle of trying to provide solutions to drawing political boundaries, their job will only become more political. So the federal courts have been reluctant to intervene in these discussions about partisan gerrymandering. They intervened in the issue of racial gerrymandering because the Constitution protects race, and it was amended to do that. And there was no other obvious legal outcome when legislatures were drawing districts to disenfranchise African American voters. So there's no constitutional protection to your party ID. There's no equivalent constitutional protection to guarantee that you as a Republican will get to elect a person who represents you. And that really happens around the country. If you're in California and you're a Republican voter, it's very difficult to elect a Republican to represent your viewpoint. And the courts have stayed away from this what they call a political question for that very reason.
You know, we heard from North Carolina Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest talking about this three-judge panel that ruled on the legislative districts and called them partisan gerrymanders. Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest says if a power-hungry federal court can order that a California-based professor gets to usurp the North Carolina legislature's constitutional authority to draw election maps, then there is no limit to federal judicial power. This is nothing short of judicial tyranny. Comments on that interpretation?
Our political system has a variety of checks and balances. And those checks and balances are in place at the federal level and at the state level to ensure that minority rights are not trampled by majority will. So the beauty of the constitutional system that we have and the beauty of federalism and our federal system is that there are these checks and balances. And so if you agree with that, then you appreciate the nuance that the federal courts are simply saying to the legislature, do it in a way that's consistent with the Constitution and protects minority rights, and you'll be fine.
And that's this edition of Coastline. Professor Stephen Meinhold, thank you so much for being with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Producer is Rachel Keith. Production assistant is Caitlin Hanrahan. Caroline DeVries is our webmaster. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org. Get the podcast or find it on the HQR app. Or just tune in for the rebroadcast of this episode Sunday afternoon at 3. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.